Well, good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I have Executive Director for the Mountain Trails Foundation, Charlie Sturgis, is on the line with us to give a trails update. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning, Carolyn. How are you doing?
Good.
Good. Well, let's see. It's going to be a pretty simple update. The sun's come out. It's 24 degrees, so things are not going to necessarily dry out, but the forecast is beautiful for good trail riding and hiking probably a little bit later in the weekend. You may have to pick your times and so forth. Really be very selective. Times and exposures are going to be really important over the next week because some things are going to dry, some things are not. And I think you'll find that it's going to be absolutely gorgeous out. And you can probably see from where you're sitting that it's absolutely gorgeous out. So I would just say get out there and have fun, and but be very cognizant of the fact that once things start to melt out, it gets super slimy, and it gets slimy really fast. And just if you're riding your bike, it just makes it really difficult to keep it clean. So be aware of get out early before the sun hits it, or get out way later in a couple of days, and it should dry out. So anyhow, enjoy the weekend. I'm going to actually head south and go to Moab.
Okay. Thank you, Charlie Sturgis.
Okay. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye. You're listening to KPCW Local News Hour. Got Bea Peck on the line. She's going to give us an update on the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission meeting that was held on Wednesday. Good morning, Bea. How are you?
Good morning, Carolyn.
Thank you for joining us. So there was a discussion that's been put off, though, the decision on the soccer arena. You've asked the applicant for more information. What are you looking for? What specifically do you want to hear from the applicant that would help make a decision?
Well, this was an accessory building application for a conditional use permit, and it was, although a public hearing was held, we really didn't expect to make a decision. We were just trying to talk about some of the more sensitive issues surrounding really any accessory building that's going in this neighborhood. The neighbors have concerns about whether there would be commercial use, the size of the structure, the location on the property itself. There was a lot of concern about the wildlife that congregates in that area. There's a fairly large elk herd that I think meanders in and around those properties, which are not fenced. So this property is not a fenced area. So we just went through the various criteria and asked questions about the location of the building. We certainly emphasized that there would be no commercial use, not now nor in the future, other than what are allowed uses within this zone. But they're not applying for any of those allowed uses. This is for private use. But we're just asking for double down on the information, collect a little more about wildlife. Is there anything they can do about location and things like that? It was a fairly robust public hearing, and we tried to go through these steps required and the criteria that needs to be met to approve a project like that and what kind of mitigation would be necessary. So,
okay. Well,
it was a lengthy meeting, but I think informative.
How large of a project? I mean, how big is the building?
I think it's around 14,000 feet.
And are there other buildings of similar size in Silver Creek at this point that are non-commercial?
There are certainly barns, and I think some and indoor equestrian facilities within Silver Creek. I'm not sure if it's exactly anything that large, you know, directly contiguous to this property, but certainly in that neighborhood, there are other examples. But we don't have limits on these accessory buildings, primarily because they're typically barns, and either if they're agricultural, they're exempt, and if they're for private use, again, we've not really set any upper limits. And some of that is under review in terms of the code, but right now, as long as they're meeting our criteria and we don't have any glaring issues. When they come back, we will review again, and then I suspect make a decision.
So if the if there are no size limits and the facility that they're proposing looks like a barn from the outside, how does the conditional use of having a soccer field compared to a riding arena, how does that weigh in?
The interior use, as long as it's an allowed use, isn't really a factor. A barn is a barn is a barn, and you know, whether we would be having the same discussions if it was housing horses or a soccer field is a good question. But under the criteria, again, the private use doesn't matter so much so long as it's not being proposed or could be used for some sort of commercial use that's not, again, allowed in that area. And there are a lot of allowed uses in that area that would be semi-commercial. We did read out that list for the public's benefit. And you could have horse boarding, you could have kennel, you could have private business at home that wouldn't be generating traffic. So there's a long laundry list of things that could go in a rural residential area. So you can't get hung up on necessarily the interior of the building so long as it fits within the allowed uses.
Okay. So another issue for the Planning Commission is that you don't grant a permit to a person. It runs with the land. So can you explain for us what that actually means?
Well, just as I said, there's a variety of allowed uses in that area. So let's say they sell the property or they keep the property, but they decide to change the use and they want to now do horse boarding, let's say. They still have to come back in and go through the whole process to get permission for that use. Even though it's allowed, we still go through the process of either the conditional use permit or a low impact permit. So
okay.
It doesn't just change arbitrarily whether it's the same owner or a new owner. The same type of review would occur.
Okay, and the neighbors, they were concerned about potentially commercial use evolving from this, and there were also comments about wildlife being a big issue for that particular area, and that maybe changing the location would help.
Possibly, but that area, we did talk about those questions, and to our understanding, that area has not been designated specifically as a sensitive area, critical wetland, wildlife migration, and I can't remember what the other designation is, but it hasn't been. They're going to look at that. I suspect it's not going to qualify as a wildlife migration. But in any event, we've asked those questions. And if that were true, then location would matter. We would have more ability to ask them to look at a different spot. But unless some of that criteria is met, we don't have the, we certainly can't force them to pick a different site on their own property.
Okay. So one of the staff planners said something to the effect of, well, wildlife, the state's position is that wildlife shouldn't be in that residential area. Was that a correct interpretation?
I
what they said?
Well, I think he was commenting on what the DWR would say, that they would rather have the elk in other places. I don't think that was his personal opinion. I think he was just saying in conversations with the DWR, they would like the elk herds to be moving and in less populated areas for obvious reasons. I think the same holds true for the elk herd that's used to be, or at least is still located, you know, within Snyderville Basin itself,
right,
girded by 224, 248, 40, and I-80. So
yeah,
well, DWR's concern is always interaction between humans and the wildlife. So
he didn't take that position. He said the state's position, but it is an interesting concept that the Wildlife Resources Department would be trying to, you know, make certain areas amenable to wildlife, natural wildlife migration and that type of thing. But you had said earlier that you didn't think it would qualify as a sensitive wildlife migration area. Are there particular reasons why you think that?
Well, one, because it's already in a built-up neighborhood. So and though this property isn't fenced, I think other properties are. So I don't know that the DWR, they would have to do a study and recognize patterns and then establish it as a wildlife migration. And I think that, I may be speaking out of turn, but I think that bus left the garage.
Yeah.
If this were a less developed area, and you could create that kind of designation based on actual patterns and wildlife presence, then I think you start off with a wildlife designation and you can, you know, mold or create around it. But once this neighborhood was in, I don't think they can then go in retroactively and decide that it's a critical area.
Okay. Anything else that you all discussed at the Planning Commission meeting?
Just some preliminary discussions in regard to development code changes, something we've been trying to calendar and get started on. We did the general plan a few years ago, and now we're trying to fine-tune and appropriately change the development code, upgrade it, and so there'll be a lot of discussions along those lines. We just looked at Chapter 1 and 2, which were really more just technical and descriptive as opposed to actual substantive code numbers, and we'll just keep working on those, you know, over the next, you know, 6 months to a year.
Okay. And anything else you want to share?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. Thank you. That's Bea Peck. She's the chairperson for the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Carolyn.
My next guest is Mayor Andy Bierman. He is here to give us an update on last night's meeting. Welcome. Thanks for coming by.
Good morning, Carolyn.
So, okay, let's start off. Council has been looking at the RV parking situation in neighborhoods, and they have made a decision, I understand, and they've picked number 5. So, why don't you tell us about option 5? What does that look like, and how does it differ from what we already have in place?
Yeah, we're just trying to strike a balance. There are residents that think we over police the management of RVs and trailers and such, and others that would like us to do more. So we were trying to come up with a baseline that is simple and enforceable. So the staff came back to us with a series of recommendations. We've actually spent a fair bit of time on this, as has the Planning Commission. And number 5 was one that would allow people to park RVs in their driveways. So, and it's something that we feel like we can enforce. It's understandable, but it just sets up a baseline. There are neighborhoods that may not want that, and many of those have HOAs. They can certainly put something more restrictive in place, but it establishes something people can work with.
Okay, so it's a driveway only, basically, and all year long.
It is, and you know, we asked for some tweaks as a council to look at how it could be handled inside yards and backyards for longer vehicles. So maybe something like a Sprinter van could be in a driveway, but a longer RV would need to go in a side yard with some screening or in a backyard. So this was just really staff was coming to check in and said, hey, you ask us to come back with ideas. We've come back with these 5 different ideas. We'd like you to see if you agree with our recommendation, and then we're going to further refine that. There's definitely some tweaks because it's dependent upon whether it fits on the driveway. If the driveway is long enough and there's sufficient setbacks and they can park their other vehicles, meet their other vehicle requirements there. What we don't want to have happen is people to pave their entire yard so they can fit their RV and their cars there. So we're probably going to have to deal with some restrictions there and do some refinements, but we gave them direction and they'll come back with a new ordinance probably in a couple months.
Okay. And then for the time being, what is going on with RV parking?
Just the current codes in place.
Okay. So once we get to what's the date? I mean, people then are no longer able to have their RVs parked for some length of time in their driveways. after we hit November or what?
You know, I'm actually not familiar with that. That's that'd probably be a great question to ask Bruce Erickson when he comes in next week.
Okay. He'll be here.
Our planning director.
What about enforcement? Is there, I mean, we've got code enforcers, and will that be how it's handled through the same process that we enforce other codes?
Yeah, that's another discussion we've been having, is how we deal with code enforcement in our neighborhoods, and we've struck a balance where it's somewhat complaint-driven, but we also have code enforcers out now doing some patrolling, and so it's going to be a mix.
Okay. It sounds like Park City Police Department and Summit County Sheriff's Office and the Utah Highway Patrol, we're talking about commercial vehicle inspections. There have been several commercial vehicle accidents that have resulted in injuries. And I understand the police department is actually training one of their officers to be certified to perform state inspections.
Yep.
They're in the process.
Yep. That's, I think he just completed it, actually. It was Officer Ben Powers.
Okay. Okay. So, yeah. So what happens now? What was?
Well, this is a reaction to the fact we've had a couple of runaway trucks that have been very scary coming down Marsac. Over the years, I think every 3 or 4 years, something will happen. But in the last year or last 18 months, we've had two, one which hit a house on Marsac and another one which had a very close encounter with our bus. In fact, the gravel that poured off the back of the truck hit the bus, and our concern is, how do we prevent this before something bad happens, before a person is injured or killed? And so we've been discussing, how do we increase our safety inspections and standards? And so the Park City Police have been working with UDOT and with the state troopers, the State Highway Patrol. And we've got one of our policemen or one of our officers certified to do inspections. We've got a set of mobile scales, and we've already stepped up our inspections. So right now, it's kind of frightening. Over 20% of the vehicles inspected have problems which require immediate care, and most of them revolve around brakes. So you're going to see us step that up, and we've been told as we've increased inspections this summer, we've had fewer and fewer problems already. So hopefully the word will get out, and the companies will be more vigilant about maintenance on their vehicles.
Right. So the considerations have to do with weight, the brakes themselves, transmission probably, and is all this can be done on a spot inspection kind of basis?
I think a lot of the important stuff can be, and I don't know what the checklist is. I imagine it covers quite a few areas, but our biggest concern is probably the brakes.
Okay. It used to be that the, didn't we have roadblocks at one time? Not roadblocks, but where we would stop vehicles that were traveling up Marsac and do kind of spot inspections and look at documentation that showed recent maintenance records. And
in the past, the State Highway Patrol has done that.
Okay.
And they still do that to a degree, but they've only got one officer for the region, and he only spends about 20% of his time up in Park City. So it isn't as consistent as we feel like it needs to be, which is why we've taken it a little bit in-house, and UDOT was gracious enough to buy us these mobile scales so we can do some of that. And we're just going to step up our inspections, and hopefully it'll make a difference. I would love to see it. Us not read about another runaway truck, because I just can't imagine anything worse than one of those trucks hitting some pedestrians or hitting a bus or something.
Yeah, it's kind of a miracle that nothing happened in that event.
Yeah, that's a challenge when you have heavy construction vehicles on very steep hills like we have here. Their brakes are good, but it overwhelms them.
Yeah. So just one more thing on that. So how will it look now that we have a person who's certified? And I mean, what will it look like?
Citizens, they probably won't see anything different. To our construction companies and folks working up here, they should plan on more inspections and making sure that they maintain their vehicles well. Hopefully, we don't hear anything about it, which means we're doing our job. We're not having more runaway trucks.
Yeah. Where'd that 20% number come from of brakes that were not adequately?
That was their stats from the vehicles they inspected.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Okay. So let's talk about the mountaintop area above Park Meadows. I guess a decision has been made to annex that area into Mountain Regional? water?
No, into Park City Water.
Oh, into Park City Water.
They had approached us, I don't know, probably, I think it was early summer to annex them into the city, period. But there were a number of things that needed to be done with roads and safety before we could do that. So we did not accept the annexation application, and we told them to keep working on that. They have come back as an incremental measure and asked to be annexed into our water district. And the reason for that is their well has failed. Those homes are serviced by a well down in Park Meadows and old infrastructure, and that has failed for those homes. I think it impacts 10 homes and two vacant lots. And so they have asked if Park City has been providing water in the interim. We worked out an emergency water deal to provide it to them, and they have offered to pay all the fees to upgrade and connect to our water system. So last night, council agreed to annex them into our water district, which solves their immediate water needs, and we no longer have to stopgap and provide emergency water to them.
Okay. And it's just 10 homes, you said?
It's 10 homes and two lots. Ultimately, okay. It'll be 12 homes. And it's right above Sandstone Cove and Park Meadows. I think most people think it's part of Park City, but it's just over the city line.
Okay.
And what's important to stress is they made significant assessments individually. I think it was about $100,000 per home to do what they need to do to upgrade the water system and to upgrade the roads. And ultimately, they're going to be putting in hydrants and such. So this is not falling as a burden to Park City taxpayers. They are paying to join the water district and paying for all the upgrades.
Okay. Boy, that's a significant investment.
It's a big hit, but yeah. You can't really own a home without a good water supply.
Yeah, exactly. The treasure bond and Snow Ranch Pastures was a big part of the conversation last night. The community came in to voice their opinions. And was there any opposition?
Well, we had one person in, Steve Streamer, who wrote the opposition statement. And essentially, as part of these bonds, you create a voter pamphlet that people can look at, and you ask in the community if somebody would like to write a statement in favor and a statement in opposition. And several people submitted on both sides, and Cindy Matsumoto got selected to write the argument in favor, and Steve Streamer got selected to write the opposition argument. And so they were invited in last night to read from their statements and make any additional points they would like, and then afterwards there were short rebuttals between them, and then we took a number of public input. All the public input was in favor of the bond.
Okay. And the ballot language is out. It's available on the Summit County Clerk's website.
Correct. And ballots will go out very shortly here, and it will come with a pamphlet with those arguments.
Right. Okay. What about, there was also some discussion about this school bond, possible school bond. People had some comments about that.
It continues to be part of the treasure discussion. I mean, there's a concern that there are compounding costs in town, and the more taxes we take on, the more we impact affordability. And so it's been a very robust discussion in our community whether we can afford all the things we're trying to do around here. So again, we've talked to the school board on multiple occasions. They know that improvements are going to need to be made. They're entering into their master planning this fall. There is no plan for a bond at this point, but I think we all know that at some point we're going to have to do additional work and invest in education in this community. And that's something I personally feel very strongly about. So we know that's out there on the horizon, so it continues to be brought up. We don't know any of the details, and really we won't until the master planning's done. The community's going to have a lot to say what that costs and what gets done.
Right. And it was just a comment made by someone giving public input, not necessarily opposed to the treasure bond, but just commenting about.
Yeah. Again, it keeps coming up in the context of what's on our horizon, what additional costs might be on our horizon.
Yeah. Okay. And then John Staffschult, he's a proponent of the bond. And he's a resident also in the area where the Treasure Mountain development would go. He told KBC, KPCW that if the bond doesn't pass, then there will be just three public hearings in 90 days before a decision has to be made about what happens on that hillside?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Rolling back in history, we were within a meeting of getting a decision from Planning Commission when this was pulled off the table and went into negotiations. And there was a lot of concern on both sides. There was concern by the Planning Commission that if this came back, all the work they had done would be lost. And there was concern by the property owners that they would have to go back, reboot, and go back into a multi-year cycle with the Planning Commission. So we agreed as part of the part of sort of the settlement purchase that there would be an abbreviated process picking up where they left off that would be no more than three meetings, I believe, to bring this to a conclusion.
In 90 days.
In 90 days. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of debate whether if this fails, it would go, you know, it would delay things or it would go back into further negotiations. I think it's our belief and most people's belief that if this fails, it will go through Planning Commission and initiate the next phase.
Right, right. Well, that's it. Yeah. So basically, it's hit the ground running if the bond fails.
Yeah.
With the developers.
Yeah, I think they would be on track for an approval probably by spring of 19. I shouldn't say approval, a ruling by spring of 19, which could be an approval or a denial.
Okay. And then finally, let's get an update on the Prospector condos and just where that all sits for the housing for our transportation department. Employees.
Okay, if you don't mind, I'd like to give just a little bit of history on those Prospector condos.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the deal is last winter, the city got involved over there because there were some problems with bed bugs and health concerns, and the city was asked to intervene. When we started trying to help the HOA and the residents sort through those issues, we learned that those units were under foreclosure, that they had been used as workforce housing to meet a housing requirement by Talisker previously, and they own those properties. However, with their financial issues, they had quit making payments on those. So those units were going to go into foreclosure. And when a unit's foreclosed on, it erases their deed restriction. That's the one way to really get rid of a deed restriction. So the city was concerned we were going to lose 23 affordable units. So after some negotiations, we decided to purchase those units for our transit staff. That's where we had the funding, we had the need, and we were able to make a quick move. And so we purchased those 23 units. If we had not purchased them, they would have gone on the auction block and they would have been picked up as investment properties or something. And whoever was living in them would have been evicted. And they probably would have been, they were on month to month, so they would have been evicted quickly. And then those units would have, they could have done a variety of uses, but they certainly would have been for deed restriction or workforce. So we feel like we kept that alive. The downside is there were residents in those units, which we noticed that they could no longer stay in those. They were purchased with transit funds, so we had to put transit drivers in there. We gave them 6 months to find new housing, and we've helped a number of them. A number of them are Spanish-speaking, and we've helped with interpreters. We've put them in contact with Mountlands and other folks to help them find housing. As of last night, 21 of the 23 have found new housing, and we heard from one of the two owners that is disgruntled and is not looking for housing, instead is threatening legal action and fighting this.
So ultimately, when it's time to start the work in those condos, the time is up, there'll have to be an eviction done.
Yeah, yeah, they've been noticed at this point. They have till the end of this month. Again,
there are two. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And we continue to work with them. It's a rough situation. Our desire is not to throw anybody out on the street, but ultimately, that's what was going to happen in June if the city didn't intervene. So we think our process of giving them 6 months and working with them is a kinder, gentler way to transition them to new housing, and in most cases, it's worked. We understand it's a hardship and not a perfect scenario. When we got involved, it was a mess. I mean, no one should have been living under those conditions. And again, they were probably going to be bought as investment properties, people thrown out and gutted. We're happy to have preserved those 23 units, even if it wasn't a perfect situation. We try to be humane and considerate about it.
Right. So are there projects that are in the wings then that will begin as far as any updates or changes that need to be made to the units before people start to move in?
Yeah, no, some work needs to be done. We addressed the pest control issues months ago. That was something we went in right away and dealt with. But the units are in poor condition. So they're going to each need about $10,000 of upgrades, new carpet, new paint, some new furniture. And we're not sure what else. I think it varies from condo to condo, but we're going to be doing that work this fall.
Okay. And then ready to inhabit by winter?
By winter is the goal, you know, because we've given a lot of people time, and some folks immediately found new housing. Some have taken most of the 6 months. Our window's short, so not all the condos may be done in time, but we're going to do our best.
And these are only for transportation department employees because it was purchased through the transit funds.
Exactly. That's so the nature of those funds. If we use transit funds, it has to be for bus drivers.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Great. Anything else, Andy?
I do want to invite people tomorrow. We do these series of community engagement things. We call them Operate with Council and Coffee with Council, and usually do them on Main Street or at the library. Tomorrow, we're doing one that I think is kind of unique. We're going to do it at the McPollin Oscarthorpe Farm, and we're going to have I'll be hosting, but I'll have some great guests there. Bill White is going to show up and talk to anybody that's interested about the soils restoration projects he's been doing out there with fencing and cattle, and Representative Tim Quinn will be there as well to talk about the upcoming legislative session and answer any questions people may have for him. Certainly, I'm game for any questions people want to talk about. Those are open format, and I want to remind people to bring boots if they want to go for a tour afterwards with Bill White to see the ranching operations.
Okay, what time are we?
It's going to be 10:30 to noon. We'll have cider and cookies, and assuming it's a sunny morning, which it's looking like, we're probably going to put out hay bales and do it outside. If not, we'll move it into the barn or into the shed.
Might be cool.
It might be a little cool. So, I dress warm and bring boots, but I'm excited about this. It's kind of a different twist on the engagement we've been doing.
Great. Thanks, Mayor Andy Bierman, for that update.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Thanks for coming. Thank you.
October is Dyslexia Awareness Month, and the SAIL Academy founder and principal, Shelley Burrow, is here to talk with us about her school, which uses a multisensory approach to teaching children. And I just want to welcome you. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
So let me just ask, where does the name SAIL come from?
It is an acronym that stands for Solutions for Advanced and Individualized Learning. All of our students are very, very bright, and we really focus on individualized learning so that everybody gets the education that they need.
Okay, and PC Reads recently held an event with Dean Bragonier of Notice Ability. He spoke to the strengths of dyslexia, and one of your students commented and engaged with him. This boy did not present as a typical child who deals with dyslexia. So let's talk about your program and how it nurtures kids who have this reading struggle.
I would love to. He is a really great representative of our school, what we really hope for and achieve and have done so for some time is to bring students in whose confidence is low, they've struggled for a long time, they've had a history of failure academically, and our job is to change our educational approach so that they have a lot of success and begin to recognize their strengths again and again and again every day. As they do that, I can't think of a better word to describe it than thrive. That's what they really do, and you see them become leaders, take hold of their strengths, and really begin to shine.
And it's a K through 8.
It is. Okay. 1 through 8.
1 right through now. 8, excuse me. Okay.
Grades 1 through 8.
And how long has SAIL Academy been here in Park City?
We founded SAIL Academy in 2016, so this is our third year working as a full-day school.
Okay. Now, studies are showing that there's a very large percentage of prisoners who are dyslexic or have some form of literacy issue. And then on the other side of that coin, there's a large segment of successful entrepreneurs who are dyslexic. MIT recruits people who are dyslexic. They're looking for that skill set. What is the compensating characteristic of dyslexic conditions? I mean, is there a certain personality type that has learned to accommodate for this struggle, or...
That's a really excellent question. I think it's part of a nurture and nature combination both. As we again, it's overcoming those struggles so that they have the opportunity to recognize their strengths, putting them in environments where they're able to use their super strengths, their visual spatial awareness. We spend a lot of time on technology, developing leadership skills, helping them organize business plans. We work on those things specifically so that they begin to see and develop those strengths. A lot of it is student-directed. For example, every morning we have think time, think tank, I should say, excuse me. And during think tank, a student takes a turn, one student in a month, and you just can't imagine the things I have the honor of seeing and hearing as these young students develop business plans, write proposals, from everything from listening to music in school to we like to change the way our school ID looks and designing their own things. They are creative. They are so good at top-down thinking, and when we help them and put them in an environment where they can continually use those strengths, they grow and bloom. I think that is the compensation. When they learn how to use technology, become a self-advocate, overcoming reading and spelling and writing becomes the minimal task. And we can do that and still just enjoy success throughout the day.
Right. So apparently one in five
Correct.
Children are
That's,
dyslexic in Utah. Is that a national statistic
it,
as
it
well?
It is. That comes from the Connecticut Longitudinal Studies, and it shows that, and we've revisited that publications report, different numbers, but currently that's what's accepted nationally and internationally.
How do we know? How do we identify that number?
I love that you asked that question early. That's really the key, looking at it early. We have some terrific screeners that allow us to look at kids and students as young as kindergarten. We have to remember that it's highly heritable, and so knowing and understanding that there are other family members who struggled maybe with reading or writing or spelling, it's not always all of those things, may be step one. And screening early and making sure that instruction is individualized and explicit, targeted for the students, really is the best thing we can do.
Okay, so are there certain things people in general don't understand about dyslexia?
Yes, I love that you asked that as well. I can tell you how many times people say, my son or my daughter must be dyslexic, they reverse their B's and D's. Or my son or my daughter can't be dyslexic, they don't reverse B's or D's. A student with dyslexia may or may not reverse or in reading or writing reverse letters. It isn't a key identifier. The heart of dyslexia is really a sound symbol match, difficulty and efficiency in recognizing structures within English print, and being able to do that with automaticity is what is lacking. That is something we can overcome.
So it seems to me that dyslexia, if you have 20% of our children have this, why are we calling it something special? Isn't it just it's just a condition and something that needs to be adjusted in the way we are teaching them? I mean, we're using an education model that was, 100 years old, maybe?
We are.
Or
we
have been.
It's
evolving. But why is it that we have to have a special school for 20% of the kids who have this situation, this condition, people, 20% of the people?
Let's look at the good news first. I think of all the places in the state, Park City is doing really a fabulous job in the public education system. They've, through PC Reads and other things, they've been doing great work addressing dyslexia in the classroom. And as a special educator, that's what I did as well. What I realized early in this business, we provided services for public schools where we pushed in for an hour a day, but it's just not enough. And it seems counterproductive to only provide something for an hour a day that we can do all day long for these students. After listening to Sally and Bennett Shaywitz, looking at other models across the country, I've really come to believe that that is the way we empower these students the most, provide the best platform for them educationally, is to be able to provide multisensory instruction in every academic class. It takes highly trained teachers, and that, of course, takes a lot of work, a lot of expertise. The other good news is we are about to bring in the first training center in Utah, even in most of the western states. As I finish what is called a QI, we'll have a reading center to train any teachers who want to become academic language therapists to do that. So it's our first really big step, and that will begin this August. I'm really excited that we have the opportunity to do that here and lead, once again, in Park City, lead the way to do that.
And that will be, that's your facilities in Jeremy.
It is.
Mansion.
It
so will be
part
there?
Of, it will be a sister program to our school, the training, the Dyslexia Resource Center.
Mm-hmm. So many experts in dyslexia talk about early intervention. But what should a young adult do who didn't have early intervention and is facing a lifetime of, you know, of this struggle, of this having to compensate for it? Where does that person go?
Same place as the resource center. And currently, right now, we do that kind of screening. We look at what their needs are and what their goals are, and it's a marriage, again, explicit, very individualized programs to find out what they need in the environment where they'll be. Do they need accommodations? How can we use technology to support them? What might they need support in as they overcome those challenges in school, but not mostly, but also such an important thing is learning to become a self-advocate, be able to say, have a voice, this is what I need, and embrace their dyslexia. I'm dyslexic, and recognize their strengths. Most of them as young adults don't. And they have a sea of strengths, as the Shaywitz put it. So many things that we can use to help and support them with accommodations.
Sure, yeah, and I imagine that there's also a sense of isolation, and you feel as if you're not adequate because you're not able to keep up with what the
right
standard process
right
is. So, yes, well, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about your school. Can you tell us how people who are interested can find you?
Yes, we would love to have you visit our school. You can get online and schedule a visit at, it is SAIL Academy, SAIL Academy, PC.org. And you'll find all of our contact information there. If you have more questions, I'm happy to sit down. And we also offer screenings at no cost.
Thank you. This is Shelley Burrow. She is the SAIL Academy founder and principal there. And she came in to talk to us about dyslexia.
Thank you.
You.